you know, the shadow of the leader and the culture that, that comes from the top, I think was very telling for me. And it was taught me a lesson firsthand, which you hear a lot about, is that, you know, the culture starts with the top and starts with, you know, how the leader at the top models behaviors and leads, you know, and that tends to trickle down. People watch that. And so I saw that firsthand on the submarine. That was one takeaway.
Rod Hanners is an engineer by trade, who served for nearly a decade in the U.S. Navy upon our nation's nuclear submarines, sometimes submerged for months at a time. Following his time in the Navy, he took the next logical step and got into hospital leadership. After holding positions at Children's Hospital Los Angeles and in the Kaiser System in L.A., he's now the CEO of Keck Hospital of USC and its affiliated hospitals. As a relatively new hospital system, he's now faced with a completely new set of opportunities and challenges, ones that he's taken head-on and started to build a world-renowned academic medical center. Join us for a very interesting conversation that explores the leadership skills he learned in the Navy and how he's been able to apply that in the hospital setting. We'd love to connect and hear what you think about the episodes. You can find me on Twitter at PopHealthZach, that's Z-A-C, or at GavinPopHealth. As always, thanks for listening. So, Rod, we always like to open our episodes learning a little bit about our guests outside of work. Is there something that people might not know about you or might surprise people about you?
Yeah, the thing I always lean on when people ask me that question is probably how I got into healthcare. I graduated with a double engineering degree and, you know, was looking to go and enter industry, but ended up joining the submarine force as an officer. And so I did that for about 10 years. And then of course, you obviously will go straight into healthcare out of the submarine force. So
Right. The next logical step.
Exactly.
So you actually beat me to the punch, because most people don't have the mechanical engineering and nuclear engineering background that you have. So can you tell us a little bit about your time in the Navy?
Yeah, actually, so I electrical engineering.
Oh, sorry.
That's quite all right. You know, the Navy was a great experience for me on a number of different levels. I think probably the biggest thing that I took away from the Navy is just the leadership skills. You know, when you're going out to sea and you're a young officer like I was coming on a submarine, and you've got a division that you're responsible for in 18, 19, 20, 23-year-old kids,
right,
going out to sea for 6 months, and trying to keep those folks motivated, trying to keep them energized. I learned a lot about myself as a leader, as well as what it takes to kind of motivate folks. So that was one piece of the experience. It's amazing when you look at a submarine how much work goes into keeping that thing running, right? It's got a nuclear plant in the back, you know, and if the citizens of San Diego knew that there was, you know, 23-year-old kids pulling rods on a 148-megawatt reactor right in off Point Loma, it's a big deal. So a lot of great process, or a lot of great, I think, engineering philosophy and stuff. So that's carried with me. And so I find myself to be quite left-brained, very analytical, and that comes from that experience. But probably the leadership was the biggest thing that take away in terms of really how do you make decisions in times of crisis, and how do you make decisions and on pieces of information. I know I asked my captain one day when I was there, I said, "Captain, how do you know everything?" He says, "I don't know everything. I just know how to ask the right questions."
Right.
And so it stuck with me. And so getting enough questions to where you feel confident to be able to make a decision is another takeaway.
Yeah.
So I was curious, when you're on a submarine, what type of healthcare is available?
You've got enlisted person there, not a full-fledged doctor, but kind of a PANP equivalency. And so you take care of the typical stuff, you know, the normal, you know, sore throats and colds. But if something big happens, then basically you get medevaced off the submarine. So they'll bring in a chopper, and they'll surface the submarine and medevac person off. We had to do that once in my time.
Wow. Oh, wow.
How long would you spend on a submarine at any one time?
Well, it depends, right? Obviously, you can go forever until your food runs out.
Right.
You can make your own water. You make, you know, the power, nuclear power goes forever, right? So you're not going to run out of gas.
Yeah.
It actually comes down to your food.
Right.
And so we could go to sea for a good 60, 70 days. And, you know, you're eating canned beans towards the end of that tour. But,
right.
But yeah, my longest was 70 days at sea. And that was mostly because we had to pick up an op that another boat was going to relieve us, and we had to continue on the operation a little longer.
Hopefully you really like the people that you're on the submarine
with.
Oh,
it gets interesting.
So besides learning to ask the right questions, are there any other ways that being in the Navy prepared you for leadership afterwards?
Yeah, you know, the thing that was very striking, you know, I had three captains in my time on the submarine, and you know, the shadow of the leader and the culture that comes from the top, I think, was very telling for me. And it was taught me a lesson firsthand, which you hear a lot about, is that, you know, the culture starts with the top and starts with, you know, how the leader at the top models behaviors and leads, you know, and that tends to trickle down. People watch that. And so I saw that firsthand on the submarine. That was one takeaway. The other is around facilitative leadership. You know, the Navy's a very hierarchical operation, clearly, and that's necessary in times of crisis or times of battle stations and those sorts of things. But, you know, you got to understand, and I learned a lot about when to use the bars on your collar to get stuff done versus just dealing with people and being respectful with the enlisted. And so, you know, the officers come and go, the enlisted are generally there. And if you don't respect your high enlisted folks, your chiefs, you know, and really work with them and together with them, then you're not going to be as effective as you can be. So really, facilitative leadership was a big deal for me. And it wasn't the norm, you know, but I felt that was the way that you needed to lead. And it paid off for me relative to the submarine. I was the comm sub group 5 junior officer of the year, and I had to go compete for comm sub pack junior officer of the year, lost, but that's a whole different story. but anyhow, it's that. And then finding out what motivates people and really understanding how you tailor your leadership to individuals, you know, it's like precision leadership. You know, you talk about precision medicine. It's really knowing what makes this person motivate versus, and it's going to be different for the next person. And so you got to adjust your style with each individual.
Absolutely. After that, like we had mentioned earlier, you made the logical jump into healthcare leadership. And here in Los Angeles, you served as the COO of both Children's Hospital LA and the Kaiser Permanente LA Medical Center. Both of those are very unique in their own right. What were some of the unique opportunities and challenges that you faced at both of those locations?
Yeah, we'll start with Kaiser. You know, I spent a good time within the Kaiser system, my last stop being at the Los Angeles Medical Center, which is the tertiary quaternary center for Southern California.
Right.
And so all the heavy stuff comes there. You know, Kaiser has a bunch of strengths and weaknesses like anywhere, right? And I think the strengths were a very... I think the model of a health plan with the medical group and a delivery system all under one roof gave Kaiser a lot of synergy in terms of things. So that's it's a prepaid model, so you can really do a lot of preventative medicine and really focus upstream, which is a great model. You know, probably the difficulty parts were there's bureaucracy, right?
Sure.
You got Oakland, which is where program office is, and then you've got a region, and then you've got a medical center. So there's these layers of decision making, particularly when it comes to big capital approval. So that was, you're pretty far removed from the fiduciary board.
Yeah.
And that had its challenges. I think the labor management partnership that Kaiser endeavored on many years ago had its strengths, but also had some frailties in terms of how it really played out at the medical center level.
Right.
And I think that's a bit of a challenge.
Also, employing physicians is somewhat rare in the healthcare community, maybe becoming less rare, but that's something that must have been a unique opportunity.
Yeah, and when I was there, particularly at the region too, in terms of working together with Southern California Permanente Medical Group, which was the Southern California medical group, I always felt that the major differentiating quality between Kaiser and anywhere else was the fact that we worked so closely with our medical group.
Yeah.
Now, when I parlay that over to my Children's Hospital of Los Angeles experience, I actually felt what we generated there in terms of collaboration and partnership with our medical colleagues there was even more powerful than I was across the street at Sunset Medical Center. We really had a great experience there and really worked tightly together with our chairs. And I think that that is very important in any academic medical centers to make sure that you've got good alignment, you've got good, you know, you share in strategic discussions, you share in the strategy of where you want to go. And so that was good. But similar to Keck today, 10 years ago or 12 years ago when I started at CHLA, a lot of infrastructure needed to be built. They grew, but the infrastructure didn't necessarily build with it. And sure. So I spent my decade there really building infrastructure. And, you know, we built a new hospital. We did everything. I mean, you name it, we did it there.
Well,
and
now so, one of the premier children's hospitals in the world. So obviously something worked.
Yes. Yeah.
My daughter actually received care yesterday from a medical group that was affiliated with CHLA or Children's Hospital LA out in Arcadia.
Huh.
And the doctor, her bedside manner was amazing. It was an orthopedic appointment, pediatric orthopedic appointment out in Arcadia. And I was blown away. And it was, again, CHLA affiliated. And the second time I've interacted. And it's neat to see good bedside manner. And my daughter got to run the hallway. That was actually part of the exercise.
Oh, wow.
So great experience at CHLA. You talked about infrastructure, and now you're serving as the CEO of Keck Hospitals of USC, three medical centers. As Zach and I have been here on multiple occasions for different purposes, we noticed there's a lot of building of physical infrastructure out here at USC Keck. What are some of the, besides the physical infrastructure and finding challenges with parking, of
right,
course, when
right.
that happens, what are some of the other challenges of running academic medical centers?
You know, with all academic medical centers, I think the key is really getting value out of the specialties that you have at an academic medical center and making sure that, you know, you're bridging the science and the research with the clinical care and really showing how that differentiates your care here in terms of either new therapies, new ways of treating things, or just, you know, advancing the research, you know, to make sure that we're so there's that component of it. Then you've okay. got the teaching component of it, which is really important in terms of making sure that we're creating an environment that teaches our next generation of healthcare leaders and healthcare providers. So those are gimmies, right? Any academic
yeah,
medical
right.
center. I think for Keck, you know, it's a relatively new academic medical center. The university bought the hospital from Tenet. It used to be called University Hospital back in 2009. And, you know, all the practice groups were really independent practice groups in the Keck School of Medicine, you know, separate 501c3s out, you know, trying to make a living, right?
Right.
And so bringing them all together as a group and then purchasing the hospital and now trying to create an academic atmosphere where you're doing lots of clinical trials and you're really advancing care, you know, we've kind of have a missing decade that we're catching up on relative to that time frame when we'll, so we're relatively new, and so there's a lot of new stuff that we're doing just that's foundational, I
right.
think, in terms of making us successful as an organization. I think the great thing about the history is that we can learn from others' mistakes,
yeah.
since we're not trailblazing any new territory necessarily. And so where folks have tried different things, we can really learn from that and really take our best foot forward. So that's a nice thing to have with where we're at.
Well said, Rod. So one of the things about USC, besides your three medical centers that you operate, is you also have a special relationship with LA County's Department of Health Services and what I refer to as LAC USC Medical Center. Can you share a little bit about the relationship with the Department of Health Services and that particular medical center?
Yeah, you know, it's not as mysterious as it may sound. You know, basically, the LA County USC Medical Center Hospital, if you will, purchases professional services from the Keck School of Medicine.
Okay,
and so basically pays for doctors to come over and serve the patients over at the county.
Okay.
And then we have a combined teaching program in terms of residents. And so a lot of the teaching and the DIO for the GME program is over at the county. And so, but at its simplest terms, we have a medical service relationship with them that we get paid to provide X number of urologists, X number of anesthesiologists, X number of cardiothoracic surgeons, et cetera.
Okay.
And that's really the way the relationship is set up.
So
but there's a lot more to it than obviously that in terms of the politics and all that in the community. But that's the essence of it.
Okay, very good. And I was curious with the construction happening. Can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, the construction, there's kind of two major pieces of construction going on the health science campus here. First is what's called the beautification project. Right. And this is president of the university's vision to make sure when you're coming on the health science campus, it's like you're actually coming on a campus.
Got it.
As you were driving onto the University Park campus over the main campus. So all the look and feel, the monuments, when you drive in, it looks like you're coming on a USC campus.
Okay.
And then just widening the sidewalks and brick and all those sorts of things. So that's a lot of the construction that's going on right now, which is fairly inconvenient for our patients and our visitors, but it's going to be great when it's done.
Right.
And then we got, I think, another 6 months to go on it before it's complete.
Yeah.
Then the second big project is really the new Norris Healthcare Center, which we call our Healthcare Consultation Center 3. And that's due to open in January, which we're going to be moving some services, cancer-related mostly, into that building. So
okay.
That's an MOB.
So we actually were recently lucky enough to have the opportunity to hear you speak at a conference. And while you were there and while you were speaking, you had highlighted that Keck Hospital USC statistically sees the sickest patients in the nation. Can you explain this a little bit to the audience and
sure.
what that means?
Sure. Yeah. So in hospitals, you typically measure the level of acuity of your patients with a case mix index.
Right.
And so the case mix index ranges from a lot of different numbers. And so that's A. B, we're part of Vizient, where we have a lot of benchmarking data with a lot of our peers from across the country. All right. It started off as UHC, and then Vizient is now the broader organization. And so we get data back from them that looks at our peers across the nation. And one of the statistics that we get is the case mix index. And so as we look at our case mix index compared with every other academic medical center that's in the Vizient, which is about 120, somewhere in that range, we're at the very top in terms of our case mix index. So we run about a 2.9, 2.89 case mix index, which is really, really high.
Right.
So it's the top in the nation by a pretty good margin.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have pediatrics at this medical center, and we don't have OB. And that generally will bring down some of your case mix index, but we don't have pediatrics, we don't have OB,
right?
we got some very, very, very highly acute patients.
Yeah, and so what are some of the factors that lead to that? Is it patient population? Is it the fact that because you're you specialize in so many things that people travel here from all over? What leads to such a high acuity of the patients that you see?
Yeah, I think it's a combo, but I think it has mostly to do with the level of our specialties here, with our subspecialists that really have specialized unique talents for certain disease types that folks travel here to be able to see these guys. So, I mean, that's been a lot of the emphasis over the last 5 years is really attracting the best faculty possible at leadership levels as well as junior faculty. And that's why we've grown from a $400 million operation to a $1.5 billion operation in the last 4 or 5 years. And so, and that's because people are attracted to good talent and our faculty.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
Our goal is to get to a point where people are coming because of our brand of Keck Hospital, not because of a unique physician, but, we need both, actually.
Right, right. Yeah.
I had actually multiple family members come because of the reputation of Keck. One thing you mentioned was all the specialties and all the specialists that you have here. About almost a decade ago, one of my first jobs out of college was to actually help, it was Tenet at the time, University Hospital, find cardiothoracic ICU nurses.
Right.
And the nurse manager had very particular requirements and would turn down a lot of our candidates. I worked for a travel nursing firm.
Got it.
And because it required such a skill set. So I definitely know what you mean, and I mentioned my family members coming here. I have a family member, it's probably about 100 miles, maybe not quite 100 miles, but about 2 hours up by the Lake Arrowhead area,
yeah.
Who comes down here all the time when he has a challenge, a health challenge, and he chooses to come here and make that commute in a sense.
Right, right.
So I personally see it in my own family. I'm sure you have international patients right. as well.
Yep.
Do you have an international program, or how does that work?
Yeah, we have an international program okay. that's run, and we've got a medical director and a leader over the international program. which in and of itself, I think, generates some volume from Latin America and certainly from Europe and other places. But I think many of the reasons isn't just because of our international program, but many of our physicians and our faculty, our specialists, are international.
Right.
And okay. So they travel and they've come from those countries in some instances, and so they're well known in those, and so they get a draw of patients as well, irrespective of us having an international program.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell us maybe some of the different departments or specialties where people are traveling quite a bit?
You know, our neuro programs, our neurostroke, our a lot of the neuro, even go into neuro this, neuro that. But so our neuro programs is strong. Our cardiac program is super strong. You know, we've got one of the elite faculty in Dr. Von Starnes and great junior faculty underneath him. We've got a great transplant program
for
all transplants. And so we get a lot of volume from far for the transplant program. So those are some that stick out for me.
So one thing you mentioned at a conference that we attended, same conference that Zach was referencing earlier, is vision without execution is a hallucination.
Great quote, by the way.
Yeah. What are your thoughts behind that?
Well, I won't take credit for it. So at Children's Hospital, one of our great physicians who's well-known, been there for a long time, a guy named Bob Adler, that was his quote, is that, you know, vision without execution is a hallucination. So it really gets down to, you know, if you're not executing, if you're not moving and really, you know, you can sit all day long you want and vision all kinds of stuff, right? And you come up with all kinds of strategies. But if you're not executing on those, then it's nothing more than hallucination. So that's a big important factor for us here at Keck was how do we build this culture of execution, right? Of getting things done, of getting results. And so that's a big emphasis of ours.
So can you tell us maybe some of the things since you've been here, some of the things that you look back and say, man, I'm really excited that we've been able to achieve this or achieve that?
Yeah, I think probably what I presented at the conference you were referencing around our care delivery redesign.
Yeah.
I think the work, it's a proven model that my COO, Lisa Tsai, and I started it. She started it, actually, but I was with her at the time at Kaiser Sunset back then. And she took the model to UCI and perfected it. And then when she came here, we said, we got to do it here. Because everybody's trying to solve that length of stay. Or, you know, in healthcare in general, you're trying to reduce your costs, provide more value in the market. And, when you look at care delivery redesign, it's really around efficiency around patient care.
Yeah.
And it's great for the patient experience. Patients love it. It's great outcomes, quality is great, and guess what? It's great for the bottom line. And so it's got the trifecta there relative to people getting really energized around it because it's all about efficiency, making sure consults happen quickly, that we mobilize patients early, that we get the right test at the right time done, that we're not waiting and having a weekend effect and waiting for a procedure to get done. And it's really making sure that you've got good systems in place to solve those and then making sure that you have an escalation process so that when things aren't happening the way they should, that it escalates immediately so we can engage in it and make an intervention on the spot.
And I think when you had mentioned the quote at the conference, you were displaying not only about the acuity of your patients, but also the success that you've had in a lot of the metrics that are measured by CMS and by, you know, different insurance companies. And I think there was a little bit of skepticism from some other hospital leaderships, especially in the area of physician buy-in and team buy-in. And you referenced something, and excuse me if I'm butchering it, but that you had created some sort of interdisciplinary teams, you know, everything from nursing staff all the way up through physician staff to look at some of these different problems and work together. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the way we approached this work was first, it wasn't a boil the ocean here. You know, we were get in focus and say, where, first of all, do we think we have the greatest opportunity? And then that's through a data and looking at our data and benchmarking ourselves, et cetera. And then it's a matter of bringing that data and putting it before the subspecialties that actually influence that care and getting them energized around it. And so it begins with the faculty leadership, you know, and so you got to get that on board. And then we have a case manager that we hook up with that faculty later, and then there are allied health professionals that work with that. And so it's a multidisciplinary team that's looking at it from all angles. And then you bring together all the sports services, whether it's physical therapy, occupational therapy, respiratory therapy, dietary, et cetera. Because as you look at these, as we approached five different DRGs and with the physician leaders, these common themes emerge. And that says, hey, you know, we got to solve this for everybody. And what happens after maybe the second round we're just starting right now, you start seeing all boats start to float higher because they're getting the benefit of those new redesigned processes,
right.
And everybody's starting to get it. And so that's what we're starting to experience now. But that multidisciplinary approach is key.
Yeah, and it goes back to, I think, part of the leadership ideas that you were talking about earlier about empowering teams and then when they start to see their own results. But the skepticism from other hospitals, I think, is a testament to the challenge that is, because you make it sound very easy, but I think that we've seen quite a bit that it can be difficult to get the buy-in from the teams throughout the continuum. In your position, you oversee three medical centers, correct? Do you mind just explaining for the audience what the three different centers are?
Sure. So here on the health science campus, we've got two medical centers. One is Keck Hospital.
Right.
That's where the majority of about 400 beds. And so we do the majority of our work here. Then we've got Norse Cancer Hospital, where a lot of our cancer care, bone marrow transplants, and our cancer care is at. It's a 60-bed hospital. And then up in La Cañada, off this campus, is the Verdugo Hills Hospital. It's pretty much a community hospital. And
right.
So those are the three hospitals that I oversee.
Yeah. So that obviously presents a unique challenge. All of those hospitals, even though they're part of the same family, present different patient populations and different faculty and different staff there. It also seems like in our current healthcare environment, things are changing by the day. As far as what public policy will come to be and what that means for medical centers and for hospitals and for patients too. You unfortunately don't have the luxury of taking a wait and see approach there. So how do you lead the groups that you're supposed to lead and lead these medical centers in a time of uncertainty like this?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. We've been uncertain for quite some time.
Sure.
So there's a lot of uncertainty. And this is a very fragmented market, as I mentioned earlier, and there's a lot going on in it. When it gets so blurry, you know, that you're not necessarily clear where the future holds, I take a step back and I say, what's going to be common in any future, no matter what?
Yeah.
It's great patient care, convenience for our patients, access, low cost, right? Trying to be as nimble as you possibly can be. And it's the value equation. So if you're focused on delivering value, you're gonna be well positioned no matter what comes our way.
Right.
Right. And so when it gets all squirrely, that's where I say, just get focused on the basics, you know, and value and convenience and making sure that we've got great safety, great quality, great experience for our patients, and that'll win the day no matter what happens out there.
Right.
Then you've got to be a realist with these narrowing of networks and trying to figure out where an academic medical center that relies on high-end TQ referrals fits, right, in this model. And how can we, you know, we talk a lot about being Switzerland, right, that we've got to be, you know, we need everybody, and we want to be that go-to place for the TQ. And how do you get there? Well, you got to show value.
Rod, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Can you share what TQ, high-end TQ means?
Tertiary quaternary. So it's some of the higher acuity stuff we were talking about earlier.
Another common thread that it seems like goes through the hospitals of the future and the healthcare of the future is technology. We're always really curious when we talk to different leaders about how their organizations are embracing technology or if there are certain technological advances that they're particularly excited about. How is USC, how is Keck embracing technology, and are you excited about any particular types of technology that are in the future?
As you just articulated, there's a lot going on in the technology world, especially around digital health and around different ways that can help benefit the patient and really be an efficiency vehicle for you and deliver greater care. We are looking at those things, but also being a realist with where this medical enterprise is at is we've got a lot of foundational stuff still to take care of,
sure.
You know, and making sure that our EMR is operating at a high performing level for our faculty and our providers, making sure that, you know, where we do have gaps in terms of where we've got EMR gaps, that we're filling those gaps, whether it be on a rehab unit or whether it be in the perioperative arena. So we've got some some basic stuff that we're still tackling. Then, you know, looking at technology right now around how we can have a vehicle that communicates, because there's so many different aspects of a patient's care that we've got to tend to, that it's the difficulty is the communication.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at a couple different startups, one that was born by one of our faculty here, as a potential solution to that. And that's really about, you know, an app-based handheld that allows the caregivers for a particular patient to communicate effectively with each other as well as with the patient. So that's kind of some exciting stuff that we've got brewing. Then, you know, we're kind of starting to build a VBSO, a value-based service organization, so that we can better manage patients on a risk level, because we're looking at starting up an EPO with the university and our own staff in terms of being able to bend the cost curve and then provide great utilization for them. And so kind of a narrow network in itself, not a prepaid, but a self-insured model. So you can kind of act like a prepaid. And then how do we look at complex care? How do we risk stratify that group so that we can make sure that the right resources are being put on that top 10% that generally drives anywhere from 50 to 60% of the cost, right?
Right.
And, you know, you're really looking at what's impactable. And so we're looking at different technologies there as well in terms of how we can impact that particular high-risk group and have a meaningful impact on their health.
Yeah, absolutely. And as technology continues to be more and more ingrained in healthcare, one thing that has been an unfortunate reality, not just in healthcare, but in all arenas, has been the threat of cyber attacks. Recently, there was a large one that made the news everywhere. It started in Europe that locked a lot of people out of their computers. Actually, up in the Hollywood area, up near Children's Hospital LA and up by Kaiser, not at either of those facilities, but there was a hospital that made the news because they also were infected. Unfortunately, you do have some firsthand experience with cyber attacks and cybersecurity. Can you walk us through the experience a little bit and the complexities that are involved with that?
Yeah, you know, on cybersecurity, first thing I'd say is you're never there. There's no destination for it.
Right.
It's a continuous journey, right? And you're always looking at, because they get smarter, those that are trying to infiltrate you, and the technology gets, and so you've got to always be vigilant on that. You know, so we're looking at very closely, the whole university is, in fact, in terms of being able to make sure that our is what I was referencing earlier, is that our infrastructure is up to the right level relative to being able to run applications and run things that allow us to have the type of cybersecurity we need. Because you can't just layer that on top of 1975 servers, you know.
Right.
So you got to kind of bring that all up. So we've got a whole big plan in terms of how we're approaching that. And then we use internal audit to come in and really audit and try to infiltrate our systems and show where our vulnerabilities are. And then we attack those vulnerabilities. And, you know, the audit committee of the U.S. university, you know, has a very close watch over that to make sure, both for the university as well as the medical enterprise, that we're taking the steps and the appropriate resources are being allocated to be able to attack those things.
Absolutely. You had mentioned that it is a never-ending challenge, something that you are constantly dealing with. Most people haven't had the experience of leading any sort of organization like you have, or also having your engineering background, so you probably understand even a little bit more than most people about it. Just on a universal scale, what does it mean for people to keep their health information safe and to keep their data safe as we usher in this new era of technology advancement?
Yeah, you know, it's a philosophical question on one level. I personally believe we're all vulnerable. Our data is out there. I don't know if anybody's had your identity theft.
Yeah.
You know, I think
I've
had it happen.
Same.
And so, you know, none of us are immune to it. And so you just got to be vigilant, right? And stay on top of it and, you know, use the types of services that are out there that can do credit watches or watch your stuff to make sure, you know, it becomes a little inconvenient at times when you're the purchaser and you're getting blocked and you got to, but at any rate, you've got to protect yourself, like your own personal safety, let alone your identity safety. You got to take personal responsibility for it. And then as a leader of the institution, you know, when we have these examples of something happening, we want to leverage those in an educational opportunity for our staff.
Right.
And, you know, because many times it's because somebody clicked on something they shouldn't have clicked on. And so continuing to educate on these phishing emails that are going out there, I think is a big piece of your cybersecurity.
Right.
There's only so much you can do with technology, and then it's really the human factor there that we've got to stay on top of.
Absolutely. Especially because some of the advances that you had mentioned, like being able to get, you know, EMR across multiple platforms or being able to connect providers and things like that, open up so many doors, good doors for technology. But as you mentioned, it is a constant battle because the other side is working just as hard as the good side is.
Yeah.
So just to wrap up, and again, thank you for your time here today. You mentioned that, you know, USC just recently bought these health centers here and the immense growth that you've been having. You're also here in Los Angeles, which is kind of a hotbed for healthcare, probably in the world. We've got a lot of really well-known, well-funded academic and private health centers here. How were you able to, and by you, your team, able to establish USC on that world-renowned scale?
I think a great deal of that had to do with recruiting the faculty that were recruited over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I really believe, you know, that doctors are everything, you know, in terms of, and then you've got to have great nursing care and great support care for those physicians. But I think that was our biggest thing is to get that out. And then, you know, starting to really market, you know, people still have a hard time in this market really understanding what CAC hospital is. They kind of look at you like, what, where's that? You mean county? And that, no. You know, county is a part of what we serve, but
right. No,
the CAC medical center. So we still got a long ways to go there. At the end of the day, it comes down to great outcomes, great experiences by our patients, and that word of mouth out on the market will seal the day. So, you know, you got to let that play out. You can't kind of force it. And then you can tell where you're positioned by how many people are calling you to want to partner with you.
Right.
And we're like most of the reputable medical centers in Southern California, we're doing a lot of dating, right?
Right. Right.
So, and we break up from time to time, but we get back together. So it's, you know, everybody's trying to figure it out and figure out where they can fit into the model. And that's a big piece of what we're doing. But I think, we're making the right moves.
Yeah.
We're going to continue to push on it.
Were there naysayers that said that this market couldn't be broken into, or are there still naysayers that say that?
No, I think there's enough volume to go around.
Yeah.
You know, the question is really around education of, and really being able to differentiate yourselves, you know, with data and outcomes out in this market and make that visible to the patients in a way and the families out there that can allow them to make the right choices for themselves. And so that's a big piece that we've still got to get on with yet. And I think, you know, the metrics are getting more and more refined over time and you're able to have apples to apples comparisons over time, but still a pretty big challenge to do that.
Absolutely. And as Angelinos, we're lucky to have two of the largest and most reputable universities have academic medical centers here in our own city. As soon as LMU, my alma mater, does medicine, and maybe we could join that list.
Yeah,
well, Rod, thanks so much for sitting down with us. We really appreciated your insights and learning a little bit about both you and the Keck Medical Center.
Yeah, Rod, definitely. And one thing we didn't mention is kind of two of the, in the sense, founders of the podcast are USC grads, and I know you don't work specifically for the university itself, but they have a big love connection with USC. So I know they'll be excited to hear this episode, and really, again, appreciate having you today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Anytime.
Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.